All right, we're rolling. This is the part I'm going to edit out.
Right. Today is the 16th. We can talk about the number 16. Today is a new moon. We can talk about the moon. Today is National Boss Day. We can talk about the best and worst bosses we ever had. There's a whole lot of ways to go.
None of those things are on my list. All right. Let me do the introduction, and then we'll go from there.
Sure.
Hello, everybody. That's too hot. Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. My guest this week has been a teacher of mathematics, computer science, physics, astronomy, English literature, and metal shop, and has gotten fired from all of those jobs, Jonathan Vospost.
The word is not fired. It's on probation and working from home.
Okay. Well, we have an ankle bracelet, so in the next 45 minutes or so, Jonathan and I will attempt to overload your poor human brain to the point where, if you're driving, you will have to pull over. But first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. My guest today is Jonathan Post. Hello, and hello to you and your multiple personalities. You don't have multiple personalities, do you?
Yes and no.
Okay, that's the correct answer. All right, well, we're going to jump right into the hard-hitting news because that's the kind of program that I've never done before, and I would like to see how that works out. Some guy made a website about you and claimed that, in his opinion, you are the greatest nerd of all time. How do you plead?
Well, the Nerd Geek Coalition of 1802.
Yes.
Against our common enemy, the jocks.
Yes. Yeah, you were the secretary.
I was the coalition. I was the acting treasurer.
Yeah, you don't seem like the leader. You would never want to be the leader of something, would you?
The leader gets shot.
That's what I'm saying. See, everybody thinks that the leader, they want to be the head of things, but the head is the first thing to roll.
Listen. When James Bond starts blowing up your lair.
Yeah.
You know, of your guys get blown up. All of the engineering people, all the guys that make those things with sparks.
The first ones to go. Well, if you have listened to this show in the past, which you haven't, nobody has. So,
thank God.
Yeah, people come on the show all the time and they have no idea what's going to happen, which is good for me and bad for them. But that's another story. I like to use some anagrams. And normally what I do is I take some parts of the person's life and we anagram it, and I do the anagrams, and then we, you know, see if we can justify them or see if they make sense.
You mean
they,
like Post is stop?
Yes, like does that elucidate some things about Post if you look at the anagram
I
stop?
I thought that was Roger's thing.
Well, it's mine too, and it's yours too. Okay. But for you, I thought I would make it a little bit more difficult. And I have some anagrams here, and the question is to see if you know what they are anagramming, the original word that has something to do with you. So the first three anagrams are these. You should read those, please. You have to read it because this is radio, not television.
Canon theology.
Right. Like, okay, here's the second one.
And hootenanny clog.
Yes, or you can say clog hootenanny, which kind of goes together. And here's the last one.
I dated Anna Graham.
Yeah, there's the last.
But she was little. There were 454 of her to a pound. And Halcyon not gone.
Halcyon not gone. Hootenanny clog and canon theology. What is the original word that I used or phrase to anagram? It's something that you are familiar with. It has something to do with you.
Let's see. Go tell it on the mountain. The tangram of heaven.
Bing! I forgot the bell. The original word was nanotechnology.
Nanotechnology.
Which you said you had something to do with that.
Nanotechnology.
You wrote a small paper.
Let me put it this way. Let's take a small pause here.
Small pause.
Nanotechnology.
Yeah.
Although that was not its original name, was invented by my Brooklyn co-author Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate in physics. He wrote a famous paper called Plenty of Room at the Bottom.
Yeah.
Where he pointed out, which is also, by the way, there's an X-rated version of that. Plenty of Bottom.
I'm sure.
I'm going to sink you with a pink torpedo, I think was one lines. He pointed out that there's nothing in the laws of physics to prohibit you from making machines or computers the size of molecules.
Nothing to prohibit. Ergo, it must be possible.
If it is not prohibited, it is mandatory.
That, okay.
And you have to tell me what novel that was from.
I don't know. Wait. It's a Kurt Vonnegut novel.
No.
Okay.
No, nice try.
That was my
Kurt Vonnegut's brother, Bernard Vonnegut, was in charge of weather war in World War II. He was leading the team saying, if you can make a hurricane form over the enemy.
Is that how we started to get like the seeding of clouds and stuff? Did they start that
they
earlier?
They had cloud seeding, which uses, as you know, sodium iodide crystals.
They did that in the 30s, I think.
They did it in the 30s. And I remember talking once to a Navajo guy. There was a rain dance. And I said something like, do you believe that your dance causes the rain?
Yes.
And he says, oh, you Westerners, cause and effect. I dance, it rains. The connection between them is beyond human understanding.
That's
when
not
I
the point.
Dance in the rain, I think of when I was a little boy and the feeling of the mud coming up between my toes. What was the question? Nanotechnology. So,
you remember the question.
So Richard Feynman actually gave a more influential talk a year later at JPL, which was more influential because there were actual scientists there. And there's a book on the oral history of nanotechnology by a history professor who said, there seems to be this multi-billion dollar industry. I better interview the people who were there when it was born before they're all dead.
Yeah.
And I have a whole footnote in there because he asked like 30 people who won Nobel Prizes in or related to nanotechnology, like Crumb, the guy that found the buckyballs.
Yep, yep.
And the question was it Feynman that got you into this field? And half of them said, well, of course, everyone's read the paper, plenty of room at the bottom. And the other half said, who?
Well, there you go.
And who is where I come in.
Who is where you come in. Okay, I'm glad we cleared that up. All right, well, here's another, this is like a little game here. Here's another anagrams, and you have to see if you can figure out what I started with. Again, they are both the same word or phrase. Here's one. Read it out loud, please.
Ferric handyman, F-E-R-R-I-C, as in ferric versus ferrous. You all know about the ferrous wheel. The ferric wheel has a different ionization.
Iron. Yeah, it's a different ionization.
So ferric handyman, it clearly, the H and the Y, the F and the C, there's a lot of three-letter Scrabble points there. It stands for a young man with a mandolin. What does ferric handyman an anagram for? I give up.
Well, here's the other clue.
Oh, French dairyman.
Yeah, ferric handyman might be a little closer, more of a hint than French dairyman for the name of...
Cherries Garcia.
You just mentioned Richard Feynman.
Right.
Both of those are anagrams of Richard Feynman. Now, you were friends with him, colleagues, enemies?
He stole your first wife? What happened? Oh, I came to Caltech when I was 16 years old on a full scholarship to work with Richard Feynman, who was a family friend who had a teacher in common with me.
All right.
By the time it was my teacher, he was a real old guy that the kids made fun of, and he would always say, I had a student who won a Nobel Prize. And we'd say, oh, the hell you say. So when I first met Richard Feynman face to face, it would have been...
He couldn't have been that old because he was not that old in the 80s with the Challenger.
Early September 1968. I had two questions for him. It was a wine and sherry reception. And I said, number one, did you really have a teacher named blah, blah, blah? He said, well, he wasn't technically my teacher. This was in Canarsie in Brooklyn. He said, when I was done with my seventh grade class, I would go to his high school science lab and he would have me like wash the test tubes while he discoursed about the nature of the cosmos. So yes, we did have a teacher in common. I said, second of all, do you remember Joseph Andrew Voss? He said, oh, Joe Voss, don't ever play pinochle with that guy. He'll
he's
beat
a cheat you. Yeah. He's good. As your grandfather, your father, your uncle?
My mother's brother.
Your mother's brother.
He's 90 now.
All right. Is he really a champion pinochle player, or is he just a cheater?
Well, his father, my maternal grandfather, was the New Jersey State checkers champion.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really connect to Finan, but
doesn't matter.
So as it turns out,
But they're both, it's round, like an O-ring, that connects to Finan.
Oh, yeah, Finan and the round. O-ring. So, yeah. So
that's what made him really famous. You know, that's how
famous to whom, you latecomer, late to the party.
Famous amongst the mass audience. I mean, that's...
So that was one of the two best physics demonstrations ever on live TV.
Yeah, he was never household word before that.
After the space shuttle Challenger blew up, there was a presidential commission to investigate the Challenger disaster. And Feynman, first of all, dissented from the majority opinion, because he talked to the actual engineers.
Right.
And in order to prove his point, on live TV, he took a piece of O-ring material, squeezed it with pliers, stuck it in ice water, took it out, opened the pliers, and it didn't spring back.
Yeah.
And he said, so you see, this shows that when it's too cold, the O-rings
fail.
Right? Of course, the other good demo is the guy that dropped the hammer and the falcon feather on the moon, and they fell at the same speed.
Well, that's, All right, let's move on. We have a couple more anagrams
and
here.
And I'm just mentioning Feynman because I wrote the world's first PhD dissertation in that subject.
Which subject?
Nanotechnology.
Well, that's why, but that was the last thing. We moved beyond nanotechnology onto Feynman.
The point is, it is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Because, like, you can buy like pants that if you spill stuff on it, it doesn't stain because there's nanotechnology.
Yeah.
And how come Feynman never got any of those $1 billion? And where's my cut? Where's
because
my
he was
back?
Too busy drumming out in the Gobi Desert.
Feynman was one of only about six drummers in the world who could do the following. He could say, name two numbers under 20, and you'd say, well, 17 and 13, and he would beat a 17 against 13.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And he was the only guy, like, there was a classically trained drummer in India who could do
that. Yeah, those guys do that. Yeah, that's what
I think Ali Akbar Khan could do
that. Yeah, I've been doing that on two or three congas, you know, like odd numbered, but not two different ones on top of each other. That's hard. 13 beats, 15 beats. All right, we're still going to play around with this because this is a good way to... all right, here's... all right.
Feynman also wrote two best-selling books of anecdotes, and he was played by Alan Alda in two feature films.
Alan Alda, I don't know if I would like Alan Alda playing Feynman. Feynman had more energy than Alan Alda. He's a little sleepy for me.
There was also a TV series about Los Alamos.
Well, he was in that.
No, he wasn't.
But he was there at Los Alamos.
In real life,
in real life,
he didn't make it on the TV show because the writers all said, nah, you can't make up a guy like that. No one will believe that.
No one will believe that. All right, here's another set of three anagrams, and you're going to see if you can figure out what was the original word, phrase, or person. I'm going to give you, it's a person, so here you go. I'll give you a hint.
This is a racetrack hurl.
Right. So maybe,
which is usually what I do when my horse comes in fourth.
Yeah, maybe you got a bad hot dog at Santa Anita.
That's a trace.
There you go.
And which is also character lurk.
Well,
not to be confused with lurch.
Lurch, no. Character.
The Addams Family values.
Lurk, like lurking around the corner is your character. Yeah, these are clues about the person that... This
lurk,
name
lurk,
is.
Lurk. Yes. Is there a K in Curly Joe Besser?
These are all a little closer to home.
Check.
And you. Crack. Here's one last one. You have to read this one.
Urethral crack.
We all have one of those. I mean, you have to. Or else you're a big trouble.
Well, let's not dick around with that subject anymore.
So do you have any idea who is the person's name that leads to these three anagrams? Science fiction. Writer.
That looks like Arthur C. Clarke.
Ding, ding. I forgot the bell. How did I forget the bell? It's a key part of this show. You ring the bell like a...
That's Sir Arthur C. Clarke to you.
Jeez. Did you meet him personally? You talked to him? You published with him? You did stuff?
Sir Arthur C. Clarke and
played shuffleboard
and
with him.
No, we did a lot of stuff together. Yeah. And again, the reason you never heard of me is... It's because
I wish, in my wildest dreams.
Because I am a second-rate mind.
Not like
but
these
I'm
guys.
Very near the top of the second-rate minds. And so my career, such as it is, comes from hanging out with first-rate minds.
Sure.
Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, Richard Feynman.
Isaac Asimov.
Isaac Asimov. Now, Isaac Asimov, Richard Feynman, and Carl Sagan all came from Brooklyn.
Yeah. What were we just talking about? Arthur C. Clarke. Do you have an anecdote about Arthur C. Clarke?
First time I met Arthur C. Clarke, it was to disagree with him.
Oh, that's a good beginning.
Now Arthur C. Clarke came to New York for the American premiere of 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
I had read the book, the novel,
yeah,
that was done sort of simultaneously with the screenplay, because I was friends with the woman that wrote the blurb for the book of 2001. So I saw the original handwritten manuscript of 2001: A Space Odyssey. For example, at one point it says, nine-month voyage to Jupiter, and on the side it says 9 months. Let me see, acceleration time.
Somebody's got to figure these things out.
Right, yeah. Well, the point is that's what distinguishes science fiction from fantasy, is that in, you know, when in doubt, there's an equation that proves that you're right. And
or that it's possible.
Yeah, you got
it. Just has to be possible.
Possible.
That's all. That's fine. Just has to be possible. All right, now this one you're going to get right off the bat because it's a clue. It's right on, and it is another science fiction writer. I'm just giving you the clues this time. But
Libertine Heron.
Now
I put the TH together. Charlize Theron. No.
She was not a science fiction writer. But the Libertine is a clue. Think of a science fiction writer who was a libertine. Sensual, food.
Well, we all are, but I'm a married man, so we really can't go
there. In his writings, especially. Heinlein, I'm going to give it to you.
Robert Anson Heinlein. Robert. You didn't use the middle name, A-N-S-O-N.
Well, he doesn't use that often in his writing.
Well, R-A-H, rah-rah-rah.
Rah-rah-rah. You have a Heinlein, Robert Heinlein
Robert
story?
Robert Heinlein. I wrote, there's a collection of fiction and nonfiction by Robert Heinlein. And when I got my copy, he quoted me by name. He quoted one of my cover articles for Omni magazine. And I wrote him like a 30-page thank you letter. And I said, in the academic world, if you quote someone, you got to have a footnote.
Yes.
But in a collection of fiction, you're a real gentleman. You are the gentleman that you portray yourself as. And he wrote back. So Heinlein and I corresponded for years until he could no longer write, and his wife, Ginny, Virginia Heinlein, would say, well, he really can't write this down. But he said, that story sucks, you know, and put it on a postcard and send it to me. Yeah, Heinlein, like Ray Bradbury, was sort of a Midwestern, like uber-American, like understood Ray Bradbury, Robert Heinlein. They understood the American heartland. It wasn't city values.
Right.
And Heinlein is therefore considered the dean of American science fiction, but he also wrote fantasy.
Yes.
The question, and sometimes it was a little hard to tell which it was.
I liked his stories when I was a kid because people were always eating.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's why I said he's a libertine.
Either eating or having sex.
Eating and having sex. His book, and
eating
then like,
while their nipples go sprong.
What's the thing, Stranger in
a
Strange Land?
Stranger in a Strange Land.
Where they have to vote constantly? They're constantly voting on...
Stranger in a Strange Land made him more money than the 30 previous things that he'd written.
That was my introduction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stranger in a Strange Land was sparked by his reading a very snarky thing by someone who hated science fiction, who said science fiction is full of, like, having a Martian called Michael Valentine Smith. And he said, well, okay, a Martian named Michael Valentine Smith, I'll go with that. Which is like Vladimir Nabokov writing Lolita, because that's one of the things that the publisher says, we can't sell a story about a nice child molester.
Right.
And he said, maybe you can.
Maybe you can.
So Robert Anson Heinlein wrote Stranger in a Strange Land. It was a bestseller because it was sort of about sex and communes and all the stuff that was really hip at the time.
Yeah.
And then what really pissed him off, can I say pissed in a podcast?
I think you just did, yeah.
He was really pissed off because Charlie Manson decided that was the book about the race war that was about to be ignited.
Really?
Yeah. Charlie Manson
said Stranger in a Strange Land
was a big fan of Stranger in a Strange Land.
I didn't know that.
And once the press found out, they went back to Heinlein, and Heinlein said, of all the bastards in the world, that's not the one I want to be associated with.
That's not the one. Yeah. Well, the thing I do always remember is that, in that world, everything in politics was decided by referendum. And so they were required to vote constantly, like the ATM, they would stop the car. I mean, they had to vote all day long. They stopped places and had to vote.
Now, the reason for that is that when Robert Heinlein left the Navy, where his brother was admiral, and that if he'd stayed in the Navy, he would have risen to the rank of admiral. Very, very smart guy. And the Navy would have launched the first man in space, like in the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. But in any case, he had a touch of TB.
Okay.
Tampa Bay, terrible baseball.
Terrible baseball, yeah.
And so he was like medically discharged from the Navy, but he was just had gotten married. So he had to find some way of supporting his wife. So he picked up a copy of some pulp magazine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a lurid thing on the cover. And then inside it said, write a story that goes with this cover and win a $200 prize. And he said, hot damn. And his first published short story was about someone who invents a thing that sends a wave along your timeline in four dimensions and it reflects back from the moment of your death. And so by timing it, you can figure out the exact date of your death. And suddenly people are trying to assassinate him.
It's like an echolocation on your timeline. Yeah, sure.
The insurance like agents.
Yeah. See, that's the Midwestern. That's his American values. He understood.
So Heinlein decided that the road to wealth and power was to be elected to Congress.
Wow.
So at that time in California, in the primary, you could register as both a Republican and a Democrat.
Okay.
There's some fancy name for that now. And so he ran as a sort of a liberal Republican, libertarian Republican, against someone who ran both as a Republican and Democrat. And so Heinlein lost the primary. Otherwise, he would have been, there's state assembly. Otherwise, he would have been in state assembly, state senate, congressman. He surely would have made it in a Congress.
Well, he would have never written, he might have still written the story.
But it got him interested in the nature of election. And by the way, if you really want to see something funny, there is a whole branch of mathematics that deals with elections. And what you need to do is get like two or three of those guys, go out to lunch and see how they argue about splitting the check.
Okay, and now I'm interested. All right, here's we got two more of these because they're mildly
salacious.
Well, this one especially. Now, this is not a person, but it is still science fiction related. Here are your three anagram clues. See if you can figure out the original phrase. Read number one. Clue number one.
It's usable Rwanda.
I mean, Rwanda that they have now is useful perhaps to the Rwandans, but not to many other people. But maybe we'll have another.
It's
more,
the Hutu versus the Tutsis.
More. Anyway, that's one.
Here's
the second word. The second anagram.
Russian, a Sunday brawl. That's
a Sunday that's brawl. Now it's Sunday like an ice cream Sunday. We're not talking about
A-E,
Bloody Sunday.
Sunday. Sunday, bloody Sunday.
We're not. It's a Sunday.
Could
like
I have
an ice
a little?
The
banana splits, by the way.
Yes, oh, I love the banana.
They're based
splits
on the Monkees, which are based on the Beatles.
Correct. I knew all that.
Oh, it's just those.
One banana, two banana, three banana, four.
It's the three layers of abstraction which makes that attractive. And by the way, let's see, Rwanda. Didn't Bill Clinton say that Rwanda is the thing that he's most sorry that he didn't deal with effectively?
I'm not sure. I don't like to deal.
But you were
think
talking about you were
with,
talking about libertines, and let's say that about Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton is a libertine. Yeah. All right. Here's your last clue. It's a two-word. That read that one.
It's rude anal swab. which is another way of testing for COVID.
They're going to have a new COVID test that you don't have to have the thing way up your nose if you don't like that. There's another
end. Or what usable is it good Rwanda, for? Absolutely nothing.
A Sunday brawl. Raw. Rude anal swab. Raw, the original phrase was the Nebula Larry Awards.
The Nebula Awards. Or the NEBS to those of us.
Nebula Awards, yes.
The Nebula Awards.
Science Fiction Writing Awards.
Nebula, yeah. Well, there's two major science fiction awards. There's the Hugos and the Nebulas.
Well, we're going to get to the Hugos later.
Yeah, the Hugos, named after Hugo Gernsback.
Yeah, we're going to get to that later. Tell me more about the Nebulas.
The Nebula Awards are the awards by voting members of Science Fiction Writers of America,
yes.
Or it's now Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, SFFWA. Yeah.
It's like the baseball writers give the thing.
Exactly. So this is like the Oscars. You know,
yeah,
it's the,
of science fiction.
The Writers Guild Awards.
And how close have you ever gotten to winning one of those?
I have been not only a semi-finalist for a Nebula Award, but I got more votes than Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, or Arthur C. Clarke that year. But I still lost because the people have spoken,
the electoral college, you won the popular vote, but you lost the electoral college.
But nonetheless, I made it into the Nebula Awards Anthology, which is the annual anthology published by Science Fiction Writers of America.
What year was that?
What year is it now, man? And who am I? And what are we doing?
I would look for it if we knew what year. It's probably in your resume somewhere.
Now, the difference is,
you're a semi-finalist. Yeah.
Let's go back to the nature of awards. The nature of awards, this was said about 40 years ago about the awards they give for Broadway.
Yeah, the Tonys.
The Tonys.
Yeah.
So a famous line about the Tonys is, well, first, you vote for yourself.
Sure.
But if you're not running, then second, you vote against your enemies.
Yes.
And then third, you vote for your friends.
Yes.
And fourth, if you have any votes left, you vote your conscience.
That's correct.
All award shows follow that logic.
Yeah. Well, that's for the people. They're for the participants, not for the people.
Now, if you talk too much about wanting a Nobel Prize, you don't win the Nobel Prize. They don't like it when you do that.
That's why Donald Trump is not winning the Nobel Prize. He talks about it too much. I knew there was a reasonable...
He paid like a Norwegian porn star to nominate him or something like that. I forget the story.
I don't think he paid, but it was not a porn star. It was some right-wing nut in Norway. But yeah,
well,
some of those things were correct.
The point being that when my enemies die off,
yes,
I will win a Nobel Prize. We just don't know what field it'll be in.
Yeah, all right. So you have to wait till your enemies stop voting against you.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, well, here's the last word that I anagrammed, and see if you can figure out what this is. Here's the first clue. Read that, please.
Simian filets, F-I-L-E-T-S, simian as in monkey. Little slices of monkey.
Or
monkey brain.
Apes.
Have you ever eaten monkey brain?
I have not. Have you?
No, I have eaten lamb brain. There used to be a Middle Eastern restaurant in North Hollywood that specialized in that, like kibbeh.
Yeah, yeah.
There's raw kibbeh and there's cooked kibbeh.
Yeah, but it doesn't appeal to me. Anyway, that was simian fillets. Yeah, ape steaks.
Naked ape,
carpaccio. All right, well, here's the other clue. Same word or phrase.
Alien misfits.
That seems right.
By the way, my wife is an alien, but she's got a green card, so we're cool.
All right. Misfit? Does she wear ill-fitting clothing? Misfitting? You're getting closer. General Schwartz.
Nihilist. Nihilist.
You're close. You're getting in there. Word-wise, you're getting closer. Meaning-wise, yeah. Here, one last clue to see if you can figure that out.
I lift inseams.
Yes.
Or as they say, up with skirts, down with pants.
Yes. When I saw the thing with alien misfits and I lift inseams, are you familiar with that Woody Allen bit from his old stand-up thing where he tells this long story about the guys from another planet, and they come to the Earth, and they take over, and they make us do their laundry and all this stuff, and then they say we'll be back in 5,000 years, and they come back, and they forgot their ticket.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anyway,
I think that was ripped off from the Kurt Vonnegut story about the aliens that communicated by farting and tap dancing. Unfortunately, they were all beaten to death in Keokuk by enraged.
When did he write that?
When did Vonnegut write anything?
Well,
he went through the Chronos and Classic Infundibulum.
Woody Allen did this in the, this is the 60s, early 60s. Anyway.
Woody Allen.
Now, the original word here was semi-finalist. So yes. When you were
I was a semi-finalist for the Nebula Award.
Dinking around with...
I remember Woody, speaking as a neurophysiologist.
About Woody Allen, go ahead.
Yeah, Woody Allen said, the brain, my second favorite organ.
I liked his phrase when he said, there's no question there is an unseen world. The question is, how late is it open and how far is it from Midtown?
You can't go at the speed of light, and if you do, it'll blow your hat off. I met Woody Allen, actually, outside the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Yeah. Good clarinet, great clarinet player.
He's as good a clarinet player as Einstein was a violin player. Let's leave it at that.
I think he's a little better than Einstein was as violin.
But I mean, we hear him in the soundtrack. But I mean, you're really talented. Your really most talented musical comedian was probably Smile and the World Smiles With You was his big song.
I forget who that is. Although I did read recently that when Larry Fine was hired to be in the Three Stooges.
I'll give you an extra $5 a week if you leave the fiddle at home.
I'll give you an extra $5 if you don't bring the violin. I think I told you that last week, yeah. But that was good. All right, let's...
Because the Three Stooges all won Nobel Prizes. That's why, right?
For what?
I think it was medicine and physiology. Dr. Fine, Dr. Howard.
Dr. Fine, calling Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine, Dr. Howard. Oh my gosh. All right, we're going to move off out of the anagram things to something more. All right, now here's a question. I really want the answer to this one because we didn't have time to talk about it. You mentioned last week that you had figured out the secret of the universe,
yes,
but then forgot or misplaced it. And then you found
that that happens a lot.
Found it again. Did you find it again recently? And what?
Yeah.
So what did you?
The secret is that
did it hold up?
The universe actually has 7 dimensions.
Okay.
But they're complex dimensions, which means there's 2. There's a real and an imaginary part of each dimension, and that's the same basically as the universe having 14 dimensions.
Yes.
Which is why a sonnet has 14 lines and a potato bug has 14 legs.
So you think those...
No, but I mean, I actually found it, and the math all made sense, and the physics all made sense. So maybe my Nobel Prize is for... By the way, I was sitting in Richard Feynman's office.
Really? Potato bugs have 14 legs, and the other... What these
yeah.
other thing? And what... A sonnet has 14 lines.
You call that a coincidence? I don't think so.
Yeah, but then where's the 7 dimensions come from? You just... If that's the first piece, then the other two make sense.
Well,
but if it's the third piece,
so I'm sitting in Feynman's office. I'm sitting in Feynman's office in the Bridge Laboratory of Physics at the Caltech campus here in beautiful Pasadena.
Beautiful.
Home of the Rose Bowl, the Rosebud, the Rose... Anyway.
Yeah.
Rosebud.
And the Rose Tournament Mansion, which used to be the Wrigley Mansion.
Yes.
Because... Wrigley had the Chicago Cubs practice in Avalon,
yeah.
22 miles across the sea. Did I mention that today was the 16th of the month? Did I mention that this is October as an October country?
Feel free to finish a sentence like the one that you were
starting. What were we talking about?
Well, I was asking about the secret of the universe.
So we're sitting in Feynman's office.
Yeah, Feynman.
And into Feynman's office comes a John Schwartz.
All right.
May the Schwartz be with
you. A John Schwartz, I'm sure.
The John Schwartz, one of the fathers of string theory.
Well, you said A John Schwartz. Okay, the John, yeah, okay, yeah. String theory.
And Feynman says, hey, I'm glad you came in here because I was just going to go over and ask you this question. What's the question? So you say the universe doesn't have 3 dimensions like we can see, height, width, depth. You saying the universe has like 10 or 11 dimensions. I just want to know where you get the 10 or 11 dimensions from. And Schwartz says, well, the equations are very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And Feynman said, So you're saying you pull the numbers out of your ass, he said.
Yeah.
He said, the universe don't give a damn if you think the equations are beautiful. The universe does not have your sense of aesthetics.
So I am a valid argument.
Professionally, I have to be skeptical about string theory because my mentor and co-author, Richard Feynman, was skeptical of string theory, and yet I had to publish in the field just to cover my ass in case it turned out to be true.
Well, that's fine. All right, let's move on. I have a couple of some personal questions, which I ask every one of my guests. How old were you when you first ran away from home?
Well, I ran away from home and joined the circus, and then they called the circus a university.
And then they raised their prices.
Actually, I remember the first time I ran away from home, I got all the way to the Watchtower, the headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses, and it looked like a long way back. So I made up this whole thing about I twisted my ankle and I needed someone to pull me in a wagon, you know, back home.
And the Jehovah's Witnesses brought you back home?
Only after I beat them in an argument about the nature of evolution.
This is a serious question. How old were you when you first...
I would have been 7, 8, 9.
Do you recall the experience?
Oh, I vividly recall running away from home. I remember the first time that my son ran away from home, ran out of the house, and then you see that look on his face saying, well, I don't know any place to go.
Did you know why you ran away from home at first, or you don't remember? That seems like you don't have any idea.
I love my parents. Everything I've accomplished in life is due to my parents, my grandparents, my teachers, but I wanted to get as far away from them as I could.
All right. Some of these questions work better than others. It doesn't matter. Okay, here's the next question, number 12. You can see the questions are numbered 101, 8, 11, 4A, 9, 3C. We're now on question 12. Ready? You have a somewhat quirky sleeping or bedtime ritual. What is it?
I only sleep with my eyes open. No, that's not true.
Would you please answer these serious, real questions? And you're
being
flippant.
The way I go to sleep. The way I go to sleep.
Irritating me.
I put the BBC. We get the BBC on NPR as of like 11 or 12.
Okay.
And it starts out interesting. I'm lying there, and they're saying, "Well, there's a Turks have paid, Syrian missionaries, both for the Azerbaijanis and the Armenians." I'm saying, "Oh, that's interesting." And then they say, and furthermore, in Formula One racing and in the German Bundesliga, and as soon as they talk about sports I don't follow, bam, I'm asleep.
So that's it? That's your quirky thing? You fall asleep to the BBC? And by the time they get to the sports,
now, the interesting stuff is that the radio's still on, so my dreams are now influenced by what I hear on the radio.
That's more interesting.
Furthermore, the reason I'm a multimillionaire today is because of the great success of my writing, which often comes to me in dreams. When you wake up, first thing you got to do before you pee is write down what you remember of your dream.
Yeah.
Ray Bradbury taught me that.
Yeah.
And the more often you do it, the more your unconscious says, oh, well, he's actually paying attention.
Yes,
you start being able to remember the dream you had before you woke up and the dream before that and the dream before that. So once I had a nightmare and I literally like screamed and that woke up both me and my wife. Mm-hmm. And my wife said, that's just a nightmare. Go back to sleep. Wait, before you go back to sleep, what scared you so much? So I told her the story. And she said, ooh, that's a good story.
Yes.
She typed it up, submitted it, sold it, got paid. But it was my nightmare.
She got paid. Well, all right. Well, yes. Okay, here's another one of our personal questions. When you were a child, you had an imaginary friend.
I did.
Your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now?
First of all, my imaginary friend was called CTM109.
No punctuation in there?
No, capital C, capital T, capital M, which stands for contraterrene matter, which is a term they used to use for antimatter.
See, when you said terrene, I thought about the soup bowl, but you're a different...
You're thinking of terrapin. You're thinking of turtle soup.
That's a turtle. But there's a terrene, a soup terrene. Yeah, anyway.
This is T-E-R-R-E-N-E.
I'm sure there's a lot of them.
You know, having to do with terra, the earth.
Did you have an imaginary friend, honestly?
I did. I did have an imaginary friend, and the imaginary friend could levitate. Mm-hmm. I mean, imaginary friends, it's easy for imaginary friends to do.
But not all of them do that.
I would like send my imaginary friend off to like distant parts of the universe, and he would come back and report to me on what was out there. Mm-hmm. All of which, of course, turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. Reminds me, so when I was working with Carl Sagan, up at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in beautiful Pasadena, we worked on the Voyager spacecraft, a Voyager which flew past Jupiter, Saturn. Yeah. There was a Voyager 1 and a Voyager 2. I was on Voyager 2 as the, my title doesn't matter. The point is, my job was to figure out things that could go wrong, put together a team of experts so that if that thing happened, we would already have a solution that we could uplink to the Voyager spacecraft at this point, like a billion miles away.
Disaster planning. This is my approach to marriage now, that I've adapted it after my three divorces.
When your wife starts like sharpening the knife and looking at your throat, you know?
Then you have a plan for that, right?
Got a plan. So Carl Sagan, Carl Sagan was actually very unpopular on the Voyager team because first of all, he was already famous.
Yeah.
We're just working 9 to 5.
Yeah.
And we all have to fill out a time card. Now, if you have a government job, it is a felony to falsify your time. Mm-hmm. So like when I worked at Rockwell on the space shuttle, they would make us watch the video about the felony for falsifying your time card. And then on the way out, your boss would say, but if I tell you to, you will. Anyway, so the complaint was, what do you mean he's worked a 40-hour week? We've never seen him 40 hours in any given month.
Right.
He only shows up when the TV cameras are here. And he was blackballed. Carl Sagan was never admitted to the American, the National Academy of Sciences. Mm-hmm. And it was partly that jealousy. The guy has a best-selling book. They made a movie.
His enemies voted against him.
They voted against
him. That's how it goes.
So I'm hoping I don't get so famous that I can't win anything.
You can. Well, you already said you
I'm
have to wait.
I'm doing pretty well with not being famous.
You have
famous.
To wait till, yeah. Let me know how that works out. All right, we have one last thing to do here, which I have to turn off my dingy thingy with this. That's going to be fine.
Turn off your ding dong.
Ding dong, ding dong. Okay. All right, now look. Every episode I have a special question that gets sponsored. And the sponsor of this week's question is Amazing Stories Magazine.
Amazing Stories Magazine, which was the oldest English language science fiction magazine. Amazing Stories Magazine
first science fiction
1926. It's not the oldest science fiction magazine. That Sweden has a slightly older one, but I don't read Swedish.
The English language, huh?
Yeah. Okay. It's the oldest English language science fiction magazine, founded in 1926 by Hugo Gernsback.
Yes.
Who had a number of successful magazines, including Sexology.
I hadn't read that one. But he started as like real science magazines.
Oh yeah,
late 1890s, science was new and technology was new.
We did not have the word science fiction.
No, there was
Hugo Gernsback originally used the word scientifiction.
Yeah, scientific.
Scientific.
Yes. Yeah, but there was a big interest in scientific things and mechanical things at the end of the.
Hugo Gernsback was forced into bankruptcy in New York State because of a quirk in the New York State bankruptcy laws. That three of your creditors declared that you were unable to pay. Even if you could pay, the state would declare you bankrupt. Hmm. So Hugo Gernsback, who my father knew personally and professionally, was forced into bankruptcy. And so Amazing Stories to be sold. And at the time that I almost bought Amazing Stories, at the time I had $50,000 cash to buy Amazing Stories, it was being edited by a woman named Eleanor Mavor, M-A-V-O-R, mm-hmm. whose day job was designing menus for restaurants.
And this was before Ziff Davis bought
before
it, probably.
Ziff Davis, that's a bigger problem. That's a distribution. Magazines and books in North America, U.S. and Canada, are distributed, and the distributors are all mob-connected.
Well.
You may not know that, and I can't go
distributors of everything is mob-connected. Beer, pork, pulp magazines, Yeah, that's what the distribution. You got things on a truck. How do you think things fall off of a truck?
Well, speaking of Pulp Fiction, you remember the scene where John Travolta draws a square in the air?
Yeah.
And in special effects, they put in a dotted line square, which gets us back to today being the 16th, which is 4 squared.
It is 4 squared.
You see, because here, when I was
4 squared and 7 years ago.
Our foremothers.
Yeah, designed to. So can I complete this question?
What was the question?
We're running out of time. You didn't let me finish. That's why you don't know. So this question today is sponsored by Amazing Stories Magazine, the first English language science fiction publication. The letter with the check, strangely, for the sponsorship was signed by Hugo Gernsback, which is weird because he did die in 1967. And at the bottom it says, P.S. If you are contacted by any of these people, and he writes the names Berno Ruckshag, Erno Shuckbag, Grace G. Huxnob, Grego Banshuck, Greeno Gashbuck, Gus N. Habergock, or Gars Guggenchob, call the police immediately. I don't know why he would have written that, but anyway, so here's the question. This is a little preamble to the question, as you might imagine. I have this thing that I have started in the 90s, where I decided I wanted to give permission to friends and family to hit me in the face with a pie or squirt seltzer at any time.
The soupy sales symposium.
Well, and what I realized is that everybody loves to hit somebody in the face with a pie, but it's forbidden. But if I gave people permission, friends,
forbidden in Saudi Arabia.
I could make them very happy. I said, how can I bring some joy, real joy, to people and to the world? And so the answer I got from some unknown dimension was, tell people it's always okay to hit you with the face of the pie. So you're going to do this. You're going to give permission to someone to hit you in the face with a pie, some person living or dead, real or imaginary. Who would you want to be hit in the face with a pie from? If you pardon the preposition at the end of that sentence.
Well, when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
That's amore, yeah.
I think
first answer that comes to mind is usually the best. Who would you like to have hit you in the face with a pie?
I think I would go with Archimedes.
Archimedes.
Because pi r squared.
And so you and Archimedes are going to be hanging out. He's going to hit you in the face with a pie. What do you imagine in that scenario? Where would you be? How would it go down? What would happen?
Well, Archimedes was famous for his screw.
Yeah.
Between Krapp's first tape and Krapp's last tape falls the shadow of the torturer. Kafka in Lusaka ate Moussaka, like to get whipped. In the trial, he quipped, the naked ape.
And
although she feels as if she's in a play, she is anyway. Marilyn Monroe in Waiting for Godot.
Now that I would like to see. Marilyn Monroe in Waiting for Godot. And really, Archimedes, is that your final answer? That was a kind of wise guy answer. But yeah, who would be interesting for you to be able to meet in person and have that kind of relationship?
Well, we mentioned Soupy Sales, mm-hmm. who had the great line, my wife can't bake, but she sure can make my banana cream.
And he said it on a kid's show in the morning.
Said it on a kid's show. And I was that kid, so I ran away from home.
He's also the guy that said, hey, kids, go to your parents' wallets.
Take out those green pictures of presidents and mail them post office box. Yeah. And plenty of money poured into the studio.
Well, he also got, But really, anybody else you want to get hit in the face with the pie? You're just going to go with Archimedes, because pi r squared.
As it turns out, Archimedes invented calculus. And since I had to teach AP calculus and AP statistics to kids in the ghetto and the barrio,
yes,
I really wish I could have had him there with me to back me up on differentiation and integration. See, integration is all about busing, but differentiation...
No.
Right? There was a time where they would say, you are a man of discrimination, and that was good.
And that was good, yes. Well, I think we have to end this at only 49 minutes. I'm not going to edit it. I'm going to let people see if they can digest you in your raw and unfiltered state.
If you can't digest me, digest that pie.
You can, we'll see if you give anyone... We're still recording, and you take off the microphone. I haven't closed the show.
Is it live or is it Memorex?
I haven't closed the show. You have to open the show. You have to close the show. If not, then the whole thing gets sucked into a dark hole. I'd like to thank
black
my...
Black hole. Not dark hole. Black hole.
Look, you...
Which reminds me.
I'd like to thank my guest, a man who needs no introduction, but that doesn't stop him. Jonathan Post.
If you'd middle like name to, Voss, V-O-S,
Voss.
It's a Dutch name.
It's a Dutch, but it's also last name, your family's last name, your mother's
It was
family.
My mother's maiden name.
Maiden name, yes.
And my mother was a better teacher than I am.
When I first met you, I thought it was a typo, and it should have been Von Post.
I'm funnier, like John von Neumann, the father of the computer.
Hey, dogs, we're almost ready. Hang on. Give me a minute. Could I please wind up the show here? If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, I'll bring you one next week.
Please.
Email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. I've never received an email there.
.tv is Tuvalu.
Tuvalu, that's correct. They've made a lot of money out of this. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio right here in Hollywood, USA, although right now we're in Pasadena. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, or, as Curly would say...
Last week.
A reasonable facsimile thereof.
I would gladly pay you Thursday for a podcast today.
By the way, if you're working on a time travel project for the federal government, how do you fill out your timesheets?
Backwards.